Plato writes in his seventh letter that he never in any of his writings set forth his own philosophy. Well, that's a pretty extraordinary statement for one of our greatest philosophers to make, right? The question is, well, if he never wrote down his philosophy, then why in the world are you reading these dialogues? Well, he never wrote them down, but you can infer his philosophy from the dialogues. But not by reading what he says, but by looking at what he does. The dialogues are not doctrines. They're not compendia of doctrines. What they are these psychological or spiritual exercises. Now, if you read them just as compendia of positions, you find that Plato seems like a rather extravagant and goofy fellow. You know, Plato believes in communism and in eugenics and in censorship and things like that. How disreputable. Thank God we progress beyond Plato. You get that kind of attitude. And then Plato becomes a sort of odd little footnote that's essentially irrelevant to the modern consciousness because we're also sure that we've progressed beyond him and he's sort of an intellectual pygmy compared to anybody who lives today, right, and who happens to be in tune with our superior culture. So any second-rate mind who's in tune with modern culture can feel superior to Plato. This is the sort of attitude that you get, which I find rankling and irritating. But no, you get this from college undergraduates, when they say, well, wasn't Plato just a product of his times, or something like that? You know, well, yes, but nothing important about anybody is merely a product of their time. If Plato were merely a product of his times, then no one should read him. And insofar as Plato is a product of his times, he fails to be a philosopher. Because what's essential about the philosophical project and philosophical ambition is precisely to become untimely, to transcend one's time and place, and make statements that are true universally. Now, Plato's dialogues, if read as exercises, spiritual or psychological exercises, can lead us to an understanding of Plato's views if we can follow where he's leading us, leading our souls, if you will. Because the effect of the Platonic dialogue, properly read, is what Plato wants to bring about. Presumably, the state of mind Plato wants to bring about is what Plato's philosophy really is. So we can figure out Plato's philosophy not by looking at his words, but by looking at his words and following them along in their rhetorical effect. And when we get to that effect, we get to what Plato was aiming at. And once we can describe that situation, we know Plato's philosophy. But we don't know it just by treating these dialogues as compendia of doctrines and not treating them as having an intent, a transformative effect that they're supposed to have on you. Because it's the effect, not what the words say, but what the words do, that communicates Plato's philosophy.
To understand Plato's teaching, you have to not only follow the words, but follow the deeds, if you will. You have to read these texts as having a rhetorical effect, a transformative effect on your own personality and on the personality of the main interlocutor that Socrates speaks to. And once you see what that effect is, where it's all tending, that's Plato's view of things. Once you put it into words, then you capture Plato's view. So the question is, what would be the best soul for Plato? Well, the best soul for Plato isn't the rational or spirited or desiring soul, simply understood, but it's something like this, if you will. There's a kind of fusion of rationality and spiritedness that characterizes the best soul. What does that mean? Well, it means this. Spiritedness for Plato is directed towards values or ideals. And we're going to deal with this in great detail as the course unfolds and we examine this. But in the simplest form, spiritedness is directed towards values. Now, there are many things that human beings can value. So their capacity to value is extremely fluid and polymorphous. But the first thing that anybody seems to value is their self. Now, a spirited attachment to the self is not, however, what one would call an instinct for self-preservation. Why is that? Well, that would be a desire. Desire is the promptings to maintain life, to gain the necessities of life, and so forth. And you could talk about a life instinct. That spiritedness isn't a life instinct, or the spirited attachment to the self is not an attachment to one's physical existence. It's an attachment to the idea of the self. Spirit is an attachment to, if you will, ideal values, unreal, non-concrete, if you will, ideal values. And what is the idea of the self? Well, it's one's self-image, if you will. And when one forms an attachment to one's self-image, one can call that one's sense of honor, okay, one's self-esteem. But along with this notion of self-esteem comes this concept of honor. And the clearest example of this is when somebody treats you in a way that doesn't fundamentally accord with your image of yourself. What happens when somebody does that to you? If you think well of yourself and somebody cuts you off in traffic or barges in front of you and cuts into line at the movie theater or crashes into you and plows you aside with their overladen basket and Harris Teeter, I mean, what's the reaction that you have? Anger. You feel dishonored, disrespected, and you get angry. And so anger is always connected with this spirited part of the soul. It gets angry over ideals that are not properly respected, including the ideal of oneself. The trouble with spiritedness is that it's a somewhat undiscerning capacity to value ideas. So, for instance, even murderers and psychopaths and so forth have a certain attachment to themselves, a certain fondness for themselves that goes over and above their self-preservation instincts. You also form spirited attachments to things that are close to you, like your family, your friends. You talk about sentimental attachments. These are spirited attachments because they're attachments to things that are somehow very intimately connected with and almost definitive of one's identity. So there's a sort of broadened sphere of the self. And one gets upset when somebody attacks a member of your family. Somebody disrespects your sister. You get angry over that too. Or somebody says your mama wears army boots. You get upset about that and want to knife them. But the thing is that some families are just packs of wolves. You know, some people would be better off being raised by wolves than by their own parents. And yet people still form these attachments to them. Or, you know, attachments to one's hometown. Or one's native tongue. Or one's homeland. So spiritedness forms attachments, but it's somewhat undiscriminating as to the truth, right? The proper things that one really ought to value. When writers like Adam Smith talk about moral sentiment, what they're really referring to is this part of the soul, or the moral sentiments. Let's not treat it as mere sentiment, though, because there are some sentiments that are good. When you talk about sentimental attachments, you are talking about attachments to things that are familiar and old, oftentimes. These things that are very much caught up with your own sense of self, your own history, and so forth. These sorts of things can take on a negative, dark quality very easily, because with sentiment comes a kind of false sense of innocence and self-congratulation. You know, people get sentimental about innocence. Sentimental people tend to have an exaggerated sense of their own innocence, which is not a good thing oftentimes. But on the other hand, the last thing you want is a human being who is not fundamentally oriented towards values. Values over and above creature comforts and self-preservation. Human beings can be turned into very mean animals by being ruled by nothing but concerns over creature comforts and self-preservation. You know, people can be enslaved by that, by their desires. Okay? So the last thing you want are human beings who are without values. I mean, that's nihilism. Therefore, the rule of pure reason in the soul is really in danger of being nihilistic. A concern simply with facts, with the logical, the mathematical, the rigorous, factual. That pure fact-oriented reasoning is the kind of reasoning that the scientists who said, you know, this is just a morally neutral activity. We're just brains, hired brains, and we'll work for anybody. We're not concerned with the ethics of these things. We're concerned with simply getting to the facts. Now, and there are people who erect this kind of really kind of morally cowardly or nihilistic attitude, turn that into a kind of moralistic mission, the kind of religion of science. There's a sense of high calling and purpose associated with that. And yet, at bottom, these people are nihilistic. The possibility of a Mr. Spock just strikes me as deeply disturbing. What happens with these people is this. Since pure reason, as reason understood as a mere calculative faculty, doesn't give rise to values, but they have to act, they end up being ruled, oftentimes, by the basest, pettiest desires. So there's a strange kind of alliance between a kind of amoral scientific rationalism and the most petty forms of hedonism. Here again I will lapse into Star Trek. Just think of Mr. Spock. What makes Mr. Spock tick? Well, it's kind of hard to understand what motivates Mr. Spock. Being in a ship that explores the cosmos and collects facts is the perfect place for a Vulcan. But occasionally Mr. Spock goes insane, right, and runs amok when his desires take over every 7 years. What you've got is a strange combination between a distracted scientific rationalism and a kind of insane hedonism. And these things oscillate. Another example of this from pop culture is an episode of The X-Files. I really hate The X-Files. I hate it because of its amazing combination of cynicism and credulity that it tries to spread through our culture. And it's just become so boring, too. The characters never grow. After 7 years of seeing aliens and blood-sucking vampires and things like this, Scully just couldn't be the same skeptic that she was at the beginning of the episode. But it doesn't matter. The characters never grow. But the point is, there's one episode that I find most amusing. I call it the Robot Cockroaches from Outer Space episode, because I forget the episode. I forget the real name. But anyway, there's this one scene where there's this scientist, she's a bug scientist, an entomologist, right? This sexy entomologist, and Fox Mulder in the darkened lab at night, and she's talking about cockroaches, and she says, I admire insects. They don't have any pretensions. They just eat and sleep and breed, and that's it. And then at that point, you expect them to, the two of them to turn and look at one another, and then tear one of those clothes off, right? Because that's sort of what it's sort of leading up to. But the point is that there's an odd combination of a kind of scientific mind that sees through values, and sees them as essentially subjective and arbitrary, and therefore not worthy of any respect, and a kind of cynicism, a cynicism about values, and a kind of hedonism that thinks that animals really are preferable to us because they don't have any of these moral pretenses that we do. They just run around and follow their little desires and die. Whereas human beings have this strange tendency to erect systems of values and civilizations and cultures and things on just purely physical, you know, impulses like sex. Cockroaches don't write love sonnets or commit suicide over love. They just reproduce and die. In a sort of blissful unconsciousness. And wouldn't we all be better off if we were that way? That's the kind of attitude. We live in a culture where there's the kind of tag team routine between pure science, which sees through values and creates an atmosphere of cynicism, and a kind of carnivalesque, hedonistic popular culture that's all too happy to have all these pretenses torn away, because after all, these things get in the way of our self-satisfaction. There's something deeply disturbing about the mind that's ruled by pure reason. Because pure reason needs to be ruled itself. What does it need to be ruled by? It needs to be ruled by an orientation towards what's good. Anything that we excogitate is not unconditionally good. There are all kinds of inventions of science that might not ought to exist. If we think in terms of ought, what's good, right? So the activity of reasoning itself needs to be governed by an orientation towards the good, towards values. So the Platonic view is something like this. The mind that is ruled by a kind of orientation towards ideals, bereft of reason, can be brutish and irrational. But at least it's idealistic. At least it has certain enthusiasms. At least it's open to the good, however mistaken it might be about it. Whereas the mind that's rational, exclusively rational, without a value orientation, is capable of seeing through the difference between truth and falsehood, but it has no values to guide its activities. And so what one needs is a kind of fusion, if you will, of value orientation with rationality. One needs, in short, knowledge of the good. One needs an orientation of the rational soul towards the good and by the good, if you will. Well, the whole the reproductive regime of the Republic is a picture of a world where human attachment is annihilated, except for attachment to the city. It's an inhuman and unrecognizable world. Natural human preferences that we have for one person over another, for children and parents and kin and things like that, or for things that are ours, right, are being uprooted by this rule of a kind of pure functional rationality, which basically says human beings have one aim, which is to perform their function in society, and everything that competes with that aim has to be annihilated or eliminated in the name of functional perfection. It's a kind of engineering mentality, right? It says, look, everything has its particular role to play, and we have to eliminate all accidental factors that don't contribute to that aim. Well, there's something insane about that, especially when you apply that to human beings. And the purpose of discussions of, say, women in the military, wives and children in common, things like that, is precisely to, the proposal about sexual equality is made in total abstraction from the body, which is utterly preposterous. We're talking about putting women in the military, and the first thing that Socrates proposes is that physical differences are absolutely irrelevant. It's only mental faculties that should be taken into account. Well, what a preposterous notion. We're talking about the police, for God's sake. And why would one abstract away from this? Well, if one has a kind of weird, bloodless logicality, these kinds of differences don't make any difference. And then there's this discussion of wives and children in common and things like that, and community of property, the communist proposals. Well, again, these are there to illustrate, if you will, the impropriety of abstracting away from the human propensity to prefer things. Preference, personal preferences, are just part of human nature. They can be good or bad, but they can't be gone, right? And so all of these weird proposals are there to precisely illustrate the limits, if you will, of the kind of bloodless rationality in the ruling of life. But what Plato is pointing towards is really his mature position. And what his mature position is this, as I understand it. You find this claim in Socrates. To know what's good is to do it. If you know what's right, and if there are no forces that prevent you from acting on it, then you do it. So virtue is a kind of knowledge of the good. And so it's possible to bring together knowing, rationality, with the good. Okay? It's possible to, if you will, educate our sentiments, to educate our spiritedness, to imbue it with the kind of capacity to distinguish between truth and falsehood in the realm of values. And that this is at the core of what Platonic philosophy is about. And the best kind of soul, therefore, is a soul that is primarily oriented towards values, but is purified by and educated by reason in such a way that it becomes discriminating between true and false values. And so there's a kind of fusion of rationality and spiritedness that seems to be at the core of this. But the ruling principle seems to be spiritedness. That spiritedness is the final ruling factor for the simple reason that reason has to be ruled by values, yet at the same time your value orientation needs to be informed by reason, to be educated by reason, to be made subtle by reason, and to have its illusions purged away. Now, if one asks, well, what kind of city would that be? What kind of city would be analogous to that? Well, it would be a city ruled by spirited types. But these spirited types would be liberally educated. They would be educated by philosophers to be discerning about issues of truth and falsehood. It would be a city ruled by gentlemen. Gentlemen who go to school and get liberal educations from philosophers. And if you look at the Republic, just as a stand back and look at the whole drama of it, that's exactly what the Republic is. You see this young gentleman being educated by this older philosopher. The best kind of regime is not the rule of philosophers, but the rule of men who are educated by them. This comes out in books 2, 3, and 4, the concept of spiritedness. The Greek word is thumos. It's located in the chest. Remember, if you will, from the Timaeus, the three parts of the soul. There's reason, which is in the head, spiritedness, which is located in the chest, where the heart and lungs are, and desire, which is located in the belly. There's a physiological sensibility to that, because when you get angry, your heart beats. When you hear stirring music, like a national anthem, you feel it in your chest. And so there's actually a kind of physiological meaningfulness to locating this capacity to value in the heart and lungs in that area. The discussion of it is throughout the Republic, but it's especially concentrated in books 2, 3, and 4. It turns out that Glaucon, whenever he's described as being spirited. Whenever the topics having to do with spirited things are discussed, Glaucon is the person who discusses them. Glaucon is also described as erotic, musical. He's described as erotic, musical, and spirited. And these are the kinds of topics that he deals with. And the musical dimension of Glaucon is the thing that makes him susceptible to liberal education. Because as it turns out, music refers to all the liberal arts. Really, all the things having to do with the muses. And so the best regime is a society where you have gentlemen who are educated in the liberal arts by the philosophers, but the philosophers don't rule. There's a passage here, let me just find this, and I'll read this, just to sort of, and then I'll shut up. This will be my end. This is about Al-Farabi's commentary on Plato. Al-Farabi was a medieval Arabic philosopher. We may say that Farabi's Plato eventually replaces the philosopher king who rules openly in the virtuous city by the secret kingship of the philosopher who, being a perfect man, precisely because he is an investigator, lives privately as a member of an imperfect society which he tries to humanize within the limits of the possible. The philosopher is a person who strives for spiritual perfection in the midst of a society that he doesn't expect to become perfect. But he seeks to humanize that society as much as possible. How? Ultimately by educating his rulers. And one of the things that the Republic tries to make clear is that the analogy between the city and the soul is extremely useful, but that it ultimately breaks down when you talk about philosophy. Because there can be no city that's analogous to the philosophical soul. There's a kind of incommensurability of the interests of philosophy and city. There's never going to be a complete harmony between the interests of philosophy and the interests of a society. And why is that? Well, every society is ultimately, for Plato, going to be partial, parochial. Even the best society is always going to have an us or them quality to it. Whereas philosophy can't be limited by those kinds of considerations. Philosophy is cosmopolitan. Every society has to have certain basic, unquestioned presuppositions that the average functioning citizen simply believes in if the society is going to work. But philosophy can't have any unquestioned presuppositions. You can't leave certain things just undiscussed. And so the interests of political stability are always going to be inimical to the interests of philosophical investigation. And one of the things that the Republic tries to teach is precisely this disanalogy, if you will, or the fact that there will never be a society analogous to the soul of the philosopher. And that philosophers will always, therefore, have to live in imperfect cities. But if you look at what Socrates does in the Republic, he's trying to improve that imperfect city by educating the minds of its ruling class. One of the things that's interesting there, too, is that, you know, the Atlantid society, which is utopian at the beginning, undergoes the same kind of decline that he describes in Book 9 of the Republic, or in Book 8 of the Republic, when he talks about the impossibility of the perfect city. What happens to the Atlanteans is that their leaders degenerate. They become hubristic and violent and awful. And that's the exact same pattern that he describes in Book 8 of the Republic when he talks about the degeneration of the ideal city into a kind of timarchy, which is a kind of violent warrior aristocracy. There's a kind of parodistic and even comical quality about a lot of these claims. And one of the problems that interpreters of this dialogue have had is this. They take Plato as too deadly earnest. Whereas if you have some knowledge of, say, Aristophanes particularly, the comedies of Aristophanes, not just the Clouds, but specifically a comedy called The Assembly of Women, you find that that is one of the subtexts for the proposals about equality of the sexes and wives and children in common. What's going on is that Plato is drawing upon this Aristophanian comedy. And so his whole proposal, or all of his proposals, are sort of infused with the same kind of comical, jovial, and lighthearted quality. When you read this, you're supposed to be smiling. But unfortunately, there have been too many interpreters of Plato who have not smiled. Right? They haven't had the comic sensibility. But Plato, if you have to put Plato's writings in any literary genre, they're not tragic, they're comic. That's sort of an impoverished set of categories, but that was the main set for the Greeks, the comedy, the tragedy, and the satyr play. They're not satyr plays. They're comic. They're funny. What happens in all of these Platonic dialogues is the classic comic trope is the deflation of pretense. The simplest example is the Margaret Dumont-style dowager who's full of herself slipping on a banana peel. Pretense is punctured and brought down. Well, in a sense, what happens in the Republic is Glaucon's pretenses are being brought down to earth in some way, and also there's certain pretenses that are characteristic of pre-Socratic philosophy that are being punctured and parodied and brought down too. The pretenses of utopianism and things like that. All of these things are being very, very jovially, lightheartedly, ironically parodied. There are a number of people who have held this view. I'm not unique or original in any of this, really. The first person who had a sense of the comedic qualities of the Republic, although he was notoriously unsmiling and pedantic writer, was Aristotle. Aristotle's Politics has several long criticisms of Plato's Republic. Yet, The criticisms of Plato's Republic are completely consistent with the thesis that Plato didn't mean any of these things in earnest. In effect, what Aristotle is doing is this. Aristotle's flat-footed and literal-minded interpreters usually interpret him this way. They say, Aristotle believed that Plato was all in earnest about this, and Aristotle was earnestly going about refuting all these silly notions that Plato believed. Okay. Now, Aristotle was not so liberal-minded as that, though. And it's possible to read Aristotle's Politics, where he criticizes Plato's Republic, not as an earnest critique of proposals that were put forward earnestly, but simply of a kind of verbalized working out of precisely the problems with these schemes that are being proposed by Plato that Plato wants you to work out. He's being a very good student, and what he's doing is he's setting out precisely all of the objections that Plato wants you to raise when you thoroughly consider what the implications of these proposals are. Now, in the Middle Ages, Al-Farabi and Averroes, these medieval Arabic commentators, were extremely attuned to this dimension to Plato as well. I would say also that Jean-Jacques Rousseau, in his book Émile, has written one of the great esoteric commentaries on the first five books of the Republic. Émile, of course, makes very few references to Plato, yet if you look at the structure of Émile and the topics that are dealt with and line them up with the outline of the first five books of the Republic, he deals with all the topics in the Republic. And he goes through the exact same kinds of considerations that Plato wants you to go through in understanding and criticizing the proposals that are being put forward. And he makes enough references to the Republic to give the careful reader clues that that's precisely what he's up to. So Rousseau is a person who really read Plato in this ironical kind of way. The people who really, in this century, I think, are most responsible for the recovery of what's called esotericism are Jacob Klein and Leo Strauss. Now, what is esotericism? Well, esotericism is just a tradition of writing and reading between the lines. And what does it mean to write between the lines? Well, it means to communicate your doctrines indirectly. And that's exactly the way Plato works. He communicates all of his own teachings indirectly in these dialogues. And the way to understand his teaching is to read all of the things that are said, all the words, and to interpret them in light of all the deeds, all the activities that are being narrated, and then to try and get a sense of the overall direction that this is taking you, the effect that it's producing in the interlocutors, the characters in the dialogue, and also in your own soul. Once you have that sense of the total effect of the text, once you put that into words, you've got Plato. This is what it means to write between the lines. And to read between the lines, you have to know how he writes and to bring that back out. Now, throughout most of the history of philosophy and letters more broadly understood, people have understood the esoteric nature of people like Plato and Aristotle and the other great philosophers and have known how to read them. In the 19th century, though, there was an enormous loss, that's the only way of putting it, a great loss of this sense of esotericism. And the books of the philosophical tradition became basically silent. People started reading Plato as just some guy with a lot of crazy doctrines that he sets out in his books, right? And really, in this century, Leo Strauss and Jacob Klein, two German-Jewish scholars, both born around the beginning of this century, both of whom died in the 1970s, really recovered this tradition of reading between the lines. And so Strauss, in his History of Political Philosophy, which he edited, has many articles in there by himself and students of his where they practice reading between the lines again. And Strauss has a book called The City and Man with a large essay in it on Plato's Republic, where he again reads between the lines. He also has an essay on Aristotle's Politics in there. He's very useful. Alan Bloom, who's the translator of this edition, is one of Strauss's most distinguished students. And he has a long interpretive essay in here. It's more than 100 pages long. where he sort of applies this Straussian approach to reading the Republic. And this is why I ordered this particular edition. Not only is the translation done with a great deal of fidelity and care, there's a kind of piety that he has. He doesn't try and write what Plato should have written or translate Plato as he might and ought to have been, but as he actually is. So you get exactly the words that were written in Greek translated into English without any attempt to impose greater elegance or coherence or perspicuity on them than is actually there in the Greek. So this is as transparent a translation as you're ever going to get. But he also has a long essay in the back, which is very useful in giving kind of overall interpretation. Philosophy was always regarded as a rather suspect activity by the ancients, and philosophers were persecuted. And so philosophers, to protect themselves, began to write in ways that were designed to disguise their teachings as much as possible, because no one can persecute you if they don't understand you. Well, they can, but they can't do it justly, and they can't make a plausible case for it. And there's another deeper reason for this that's less accidental, less political, if you will. And that's their conception of philosophy was not as just a set of doctrines, but as a way of life, again. And the purpose of a philosophical text was not simply to communicate the teachings of a school in a way that was accessible to any bloke who wanted to pick it up and read, right? Their popularization was regarded as bizarre and vulgar. The purpose of these texts were to be, they were texts that existed within the context of a living oral tradition, a school. And their meaning was interpreted in light of the oral tradition of the school. Their purpose was to aid the student in undergoing a kind of internal transformation of the soul, which was understood to be the goal of philosophy because the well-ordered soul was precisely the healthy and happy soul. And the end of it all, the goal of it all, was happiness.